Hi, I'm here with Dr. Loretta Reeves, who is a professor of developmental and cognitive psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, where she has been teaching for 25 years. She is going to talk to me today about human attachment. So, Loretta, thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome. But just to clarify, I've only been at UT for 20 years, although I've been teaching for 25. I was on the East Coast before that in New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
Well, we're really glad to have you here. So today we are talking about attachment. Can you define attachment? I mean, both of us know what it is, but for someone listening in the audience, how would you define it?
In general, you know, lay people define attachment as the emotional connection that you have to another person. Traditionally in psychology, it used to be used only to mean the attachment of the child to a caregiver. And then they would sometimes use caregiver bond to describe the sense of connection and love of a caregiver to a child. But really, it's interchangeable. And certainly many theorists think that, you know, there's this kind of two-way interaction where caregiver and child interactions lead to a bond, usually, and one hopes, on both their parts.
So why do we attach?
We are social creatures, right? So we evolved to be social creatures, to live in social settings. And the most prominent attachment theorist is John Bowlby, who was influenced both by his background in Freudian psychology, but also, I think, more heavily by his interaction and long correspondence with ethologists who were people who said that, well, attachment is an instinct, that it's an innate predisposition to a set of behaviors that promote survival value, not because the children who attach are better at getting food, but more because of a sense of security, that there's a sense of protection when one attaches that causes you to stay really close to your caregiver. And as a result, you're much more likely to survive. And so then it's also been built in as a set of emotions that go along with that tendency to stay close to the caregiver.
Okay, noted. So what are the main attachment styles? And can you tell me a little bit about what each one is and what it looks like?
The attachment styles came from Mary Ainsworth, who was a colleague of John Bowlby's. And she came up with a very interesting technique to study the security of attachment in the laboratory. And it sounds like this terribly artificial set of scenarios, but it turns out to actually have pretty good validity in terms of whether a child is securely or insecurely attached to a caregiver figure. So what she did is to have a series of events where child and in her case, the mother would come into the lab, an experimenter would come into the same room. There would be toys in the room so the child could explore and play. And then the mother would leave and come back, and the experimenter would try to engage with the child. And then both of them would leave, and they would observe the child's behavior. So based on this scenario, she came up initially with three different kinds of attachment. Secure attachment, where a child very clearly misses their mother, they're upset that the mother has gone, and then they show a sense of relief when she comes back. And they might interact with the experimenter, but mainly they clearly prefer the caregiver. The two kinds of insecure attachment that she discovered were what is typically called resistant or ambivalent. And these are kids who clearly miss their mother, but then when she comes back in, they're very clingy. They don't settle down. They remain upset. They may even show some anger. The second kind of insecure attachment she saw was that kids who were kind of indifferent. When their mother left, they would happily either interact with the experimenter, or they would play with the toys. When the mother came back in, they would really not engage with her. And she called these avoidant attachment. Since that time, they've discovered a fourth kind of attachment through what's called the strange situation scenario. And these are kids who show a mix of insecure attachment. So they may freeze up if their mother tries to hold them when she comes back in, but they are obviously distressed. They may never quiet down, and they just appear kind of confused. And sadly, that kind of attachment is usually associated with children who have been abused or neglected.
Okay, noted. So are these attachment styles, are they inherent to a person or do they develop from interactions that the person has had? Is there any role that infant temperament plays in developing attachment style?
Great question. It was traditionally assumed that it was the responsiveness of the mother that determined the attachment. And clearly there is a lot of evidence that the more responsive a mother, the more likely a child is to have a secure attachment. But we can't really ignore that the child brings traits to the situation themselves. So, you know, we think of kids as having a temperament, which is oftentimes innate. It's not a full-blown personality, but some kids are just much easier than others. Some want more connection than others. Some want more physical contact than others. And Mary Ainsworth came up with what I think is probably a better concept of attunement. That's the where the mother's behaviors and the child's temperament mesh well, so that the responsiveness of the mother is due to paying attention to what the child wants. That is, if the child wants a high amount of independence, then the mother backs off and lets them have that independence. But if a child wants to be more clingy and wants more physical affection, then the mother gives that. So it does look as if the child's temperament does play a role in that whole attachment interaction that, you know, not all kids are the same. They don't come into the world as tabula rasa. And the more a parent or caregiver pays attention to what the child needs, then the more likely you are to have a secure attachment.
So how can parents help their children to develop healthy attachment styles?
A lot of this, of course, starts in infancy that, you know, even Erik Erikson said, you want the child to develop a sense of trust that if they have needs, whether those needs are really basic, like food or comfort or having their diaper changed, that they can trust that a caregiver is going to take care of them, because obviously they're so unable to take care of themselves in that first year. But then you can't just kind of get a child to secure attachment by 12 or 18 months of age, and then you go, okay, well, now I can ignore them, right? You still have to interact with them. You still have to pay attention to what their needs are. So children usually around 18 months will become more independent, right? There's all these jokes about two-year-olds who just say no and instinctively because they want to assert themselves as independent. So you kind of have to pay attention to that while still giving them responsiveness as to both their needs physically and psychologically.
Noted. So when we're looking at parents, when we see attachment problems, do those start in infancy? How do attachment problems begin?
So whether this is good news or bad news, right? Infant attachment style is not static. It's not as if once you have a child who gets to secure attachment by 18 months, that it doesn't matter what you do anymore. So attachment styles can change even in childhood. I'll give you an example. I knew a woman who had two children, a three-year-old and then a one-year-old. And sadly, the one-year-old came down with leukemia. So the parents were at the hospital constantly until the little boy passed away after about 6 months. And so the older child, the three-year-old, was living with the grandparents. Well, his attachment shifted from the mother and the father to the grandmother because she was the one giving him all the comfort, you know, meeting his needs. And it took a while for him to then gravitate back toward the parents. So what you could say is he changed from a secure attachment to an insecure attachment to his parents when they weren't around for 6 months because they were at the hospital with the younger brother. So it's not as if these things are just completely static, which the bad news of that is that, you know, it's continued work on the part of the parents. They still have to pay attention to being responsive to the kid. The good news is for people who don't have a secure attachment or at some point, like that little three-year-old, develop an insecure attachment, there are ways to change it back.
Very interesting. I know many anxious and avoidant people who had terrific parents who loved them and, as far as I know, gave them terrific care and nurturing. If someone has parents who are consistently there, who do love them, who do provide them with that attention, what might cause them to develop insecure attachment styles?
Some of it dates back to temperament, so that you could have two children with the exact same parents who share 50% of their genes, and yet one child is securely attached and one is not. And some of that clearly has to do with the temperament. One type of temperament style is labeled as difficult. These are children who do not show regular sleep and wake cycles. They demand a lot more of parents, but then if they don't get exactly what they want, they may have a lot of emotional negativity. And over time, that can wear the parent down. There's one really interesting study where they took a pacifier out of children's mouth at 2 days of age. And then they looked at the attachment style of the same kids at 14 months. The kids who at 2 days of age had their pacifier taken out of their mouth and just really wailed, they were not happy and they had a lot of negative emotion, were more likely to be insecurely attached at 14 months. And what the experimenters think was going on there is that the kids who had the more difficult temperament, and so they were really angry that the pacifier had been taken out of their mouth, that over time, they kind of wore the parents down because the parents may have been giving all this responsiveness and warmth and love, but they weren't getting positive feedback back, that the child was just simply more emotionally negative. And as a result, they were at higher risk of having an insecure attachment. So, you know, what happens in between with the interactions, it's certainly a two-way street. And it's that interaction that's going to determine the stability of a secure attachment and whether you have one to begin with.
So let me get this straight. So you've got parents who are loving and caring and nurturing, and they've got this child who at a very early age is disagreeable and difficult and cries all the time and just no fun to be around. So you're saying what happens is the parents get worn down and they stop caring for the child as much? Or is it that no matter how much love and care the parent gives the child, they're always going to be kind of difficult and have a higher disposition for insecure attachment or a higher tendency for insecure attachment?
Both things can happen, right? You could have a parent who continues to keep giving lots of positive hugs and affection and trying to pay attention to the child's needs. But because the child is difficult, it's never enough. And so in that case, then it runs the risk of the child still maintaining an insecure attachment over time. Or it could be that the child does wear the parent down and they stop being quite as responsive, even in very subtle ways. So there's an experimental technique that was developed by Edward Tronick, where he would have parents come into the lab and just interact with their child, usually under 1 year of age. And then he would tell them, okay, do not show any emotion. Do not interact with the child for 2 minutes. That's it. And kids would get so upset. They would try everything they could just to engage their parents again. And obviously, 2 minutes is not going to lead to long-term damage on the part of these kids if they participated in the experiment. But imagine a parent who was doing that all the time, either because they found the child very difficult and so, you know, they weren't quite as happy to be parenting, or depressed mothers. So think about people who have postpartum depression who clearly do love their child, but their own depression sometimes takes over. And so they're very inconsistent in the amount of care that they give to the kid. That can have an impact over time in a very subtle way.
That's super interesting. So when we look at inconsistent parenting, what about children in places like Gosh, we talked about this when I was an undergrad, the Romanian orphanages where kids were not given any care. What happens with those kids when they get older?
Yeah, that's a very awful situation. So the Romanian dictator at the time forbid anyone to use birth control because he wanted to build up the Romanian population. And as a result, many people couldn't afford to have multiple kids, so they would simply drop them off at hospitals. And the hospitals were just completely overbooked. So these kids were put into orphanages. Some of them did have physical problems. So for example, they were born prematurely and then didn't get the care afterwards that they needed. The orphanages varied. So some of them were higher quality than others, where children were getting some degree of stimulation and some degree of care. And kids in other orphanages, you know, it was more like a prison. So they were getting fed, sometimes not even consistently, barely getting enough medical care, and they certainly were not getting any kind of emotional attachment to their caregivers. So many of those children ended up with what the DSM calls reactive attachment disorder. And there are two different kinds of it. Some who are just fearful. They're fearful of people. They can't count on adults to meet their needs. And so they just avoid them and they get very upset if someone tries to pick them up. And then the alternative, the disinhibited, they seek attention from anybody, but there's no real attachment there and they don't really know how to behave in a way that is healthy. And both are problematic. So a lot of people, once the Romanian orphans started to come to the forefront because of documentaries, they would adopt these kids because they felt so horrible that they were in these orphanages. And sadly, these kids had a lot of problems, a lot of emotional problems, ranging from really sociopathy, so that some of these kids were coming over and already before age five, very violent and aggressive. And then others who just would not attach normally and stayed very fearful. And it's not just Romanian orphans. We've seen the same thing happen with Russian orphans, Chinese orphans, that if they don't attach to at least one caregiver within a certain length of time, Bowlby thought within the first 2 years, they may never attach normally.
So let's say you've had a really hard upbringing and you have a reactive attachment style, or someone you love has a reactive attachment style. What steps can be taken? What can you do personally to rehabilitate yourself or the person you love, you know, if you're able to rehabilitate them?
It's not easy. And the reactive attachment disorder is considered pathological. So that one is very difficult to fully overcome. It possibly can be done with a lot of love and support. So some of the orphans who ended up with reactive attachment disorder, but then were adopted by very loving homes, may be able to overcome that. More specifically, though, I think people who have insecure attachments, as opposed to the pathological kind, the reactive attachment disorder, it's probably a lot easier to change those so that kids who are coming with either an avoidant attachment style or resistant attachment style are probably going to have a little bit easier time. Combination, I would say, of self-awareness, therapy, and then sometimes it takes getting into relationships and failing and thinking through, okay, why did that relationship fail? What did I contribute to it? And then realizing, okay, if you're, you know, anxious attachment, maybe I was too clingy, that I need to work on that. And so sometimes it's just a matter of working through your issues with some relationships, or sometimes just with friendships, because the same issues can crop up.
Noted. So that makes me wonder, what are the most common attachment pairings in romantic relationships? Which ones do you feel like you see the most of, or, you know, statistically you might see the most of, and which ones do you think are the best?
The longest lasting ones tend to be one of two kinds, either secure-secure, because those are people who both have the right balance of intimacy and independence, and they tolerate the other person's idiosyncrasies, that they have good communication skills, and they do rely on each other when necessary. The other kind of long-lasting attachment combination is sadly anxious with avoidant. So the adult attachment styles are by and large very similar to the infant ones, but avoidant gets divided in the adult one into either dismissive avoidant, and that's pretty much as it sounds. So these people are willing to have relationships as long as it fits within their little box, but if it gets too intimate, they're bailing. And then there's fearful avoidant. These are people who probably want a relationship more, but they also have a sense of fear about other people, which causes them not to be quite as intimate. And sadly, the dismissive avoidant attachment style combined with an anxious or resistant attachment style tends to be long lasting because it's this pathological cat and mouse game. So the anxious person tries to rope in the avoidant person. And the avoidant person is kind of happy about that because then they're not doing very much of the work. And yet they feel very loved because this person obviously wants them. But then when it gets too much, they run away. They give the other person the silent treatment, which causes a kind of addictive response in the anxious person because they want the avoidant person to come back. And after a time, perhaps the avoidant person will, but it then increases the anxiety of the anxious or resistant attachment person. And so you just get this round robin of push me, pull you, if you will. And so they can actually last a long time because they're complementing each other, but not in a healthy way.
Noted. So I do have a few questions about that then. First, okay, I heard you say dismissive avoidant and fearful avoidant. What is the difference between those two?
It's sometimes tough to just put people into one group or another because, so some researchers think that dismissive avoidant don't really want a relationship, that, you know, they do it because it's convenient and it kind of feels good, but then as soon as it stops feeling good or the other person demands too much of them, they're just willing to go, I'm done. And there are other researchers who claim, no, all avoidant people typically do want a relationship. It's just an issue of how much are they going to tolerate to stay in a relationship and what is their response upon a breakup. So the dismissive avoidant will just go cold. And the fearful avoidant may show some signs that are very similar to the anxiously attached person, where they are constantly texting the other person to try and get back together, or they'll go off on tangents or vacillate between wanting to withdraw and wanting the other person to come back to them. So that's one of those cases where it may have to do mostly with the degree of, I don't want to say public emotionality, but certainly the emotionality that they show, that the dismissive avoidant is much more likely to just show very little emotion.
Got it. So can anyone ever be in a healthy relationship with someone who's avoidantly attached? Has that happened? And if so, don't laugh. It's a real question.
I'm sure there are moderately happy relationships where a secure person with an avoidant person can have a long-lasting relationship. Is the secure person necessarily going to get all of their emotional needs met by the avoidant person? Quite possibly not. But if they're secure, they may also have lots of friends that they can rely on for emotional sustenance. And they just kind of let the avoidant person go off and be their mega independent self every once in a while. And because they're securely attached themselves or have a sense of self-confidence and high self-esteem, then they may be perfectly fine and just go, okay, well, you know, he's being him and I'll just go off and do my own thing. Because a sense of security also builds a sense of, well, I can be independent if I need to.
That makes a lot of sense. So on that note, one of my good friends is a dismissive avoidant, and she has decided that she really only wants to date other dismissive avoidants because people who are anxious and people who are secure tend to annoy her. Can she have a healthy relationship with someone who is a dismissive avoidant like her? And if so, what would that look like?
In principle, it should be possible for two dismissive avoidants to be in a relationship together because then they both understand the ground rules that we're both going to be mega independent and we're not going to ask too much from each other. However, you know, all relationships at some point involve conflict. Once that conflict occurs, dismissive avoidants are more likely to just throw in the towel. They do have typically a higher risk of breakup, and they tend to last less long than other combinations of attachment style. But you can see where if they came to some kind of agreement about just how much intimacy there was going to be, and they both agreed on it, then in principle, it may work.
That's very interesting. So before we did this podcast, I went online and I just looked up what the most common attachment pairings are in relationships. I know there's probably no good way to measure this because it's all very subjective and it's based on what people are telling you. It looks like the most common pairing is secure-secure, followed by anxious-avoidant, which is not surprising to either of us. We know a lot of people who are anxious and after avoidance. I feel like the majority of my friends who are having relationship problems, it's like they're anxious and their partner is avoidant or vice versa. Then after that comes secure anxious, then anxious anxious, then avoidant avoidant, and finally secure avoidant. In fact, secure avoidant is the least common pairing out of all the pairings. It almost never happens. Securely attached people almost never date avoidance. Why do you think that is?
Well, securely attached people might start dating avoidance, But once they realize that they're not going to get the level of intimacy that they want, then one of two things will happen. Either they will go, well, thanks very much, but this isn't really meeting my needs. I have tried. And they'll exit the relationship. The second thing that can happen is if they stay, a securely attached person can start to become anxiously attached because they're trying to maintain the relationship, and yet they know that the other person has one foot out the door or just isn't as fully invested. And so then they start to get anxious and possibly do things to help keep the other person in. And so then you go from a secure avoidant to an anxious avoidant relationship.
Oh gosh, Loretta, has that ever happened to you? Don't laugh.
Yeah, yes, it has. And I should say, I did not start out life securely attached. You know, I came from a chaotic family. And certainly my first college boyfriend, I would consider myself very anxious. And he was avoidant. It lasted 5 years, but it was very on and off. And I was very unhappy for most of it. And so over time, I learned, okay, well, what is it that I want to bring to a relationship? What is it that I want from a relationship? And I became securely attached until I ran into a person who very much disguised their avoidance and appeared to be very secure until I realized that he was lying a lot and hiding many things from me. And in the couple of months before it all went south, I could see I was starting to become more insecure and worry about things that I hadn't been worrying about before. So thankfully, I'm now back to secure, you know, having exited that relationship.
So it sounds like we all really want to avoid dating avoidant people, unless maybe they've done a lot of work around themselves. So what are signs that someone is avoidant?
Avoidant attachment people can also be extremely charming because they do want to connect to other people. It's just that they typically want to do it on their own terms, and they don't even realize this, or they really don't want to invest too much. So one of the best things you can look for is, does that person ever rely on you when there's a crisis? Do they call you for help? Do they call you just to bend your ear as a sense of support? Or do they try and handle everything in their life independently? And if you ask them intimate questions, that they get very evasive or they just simply refuse to answer. And they may be charming enough to joke their way out of having to answer. But that sense of independence, that they don't want to emotionally rely on anyone else, especially in times of crisis, is probably the best way to detect it. And over time, avoidance will always give themselves away. Could you date an avoidant as a secure person? Yeah. So imagine that you really didn't want a long-term relationship, right? That you wanted someone to just hang out with, that you were perfectly content to live your own life and you weren't really looking for something long-term, then it might be okay to date an avoidant, knowing that it was probably going to end at some point, but that you might have a lot of fun in the meantime.
Avoidants make up, I think, 25% of all attachment styles. It's relatively common. It doesn't sound like you think an avoidant person can be a healthy person to be in a relationship with. I know I've kind of asked you this question already, but do you think it's ever a good idea to get into a relationship with someone who's avoidantly attached?
There are certainly researchers who tell people avoid under any circumstances because you are not going to get what you need from that relationship. It could make you anxious even if you start out securely attached. I think under limited scenarios, you may be able to be in a relationship with an avoidant person, but I think you would need a lot of other social support from friends because when push comes to shove, you're possibly not going to get it from avoidance. But it's very hard to detect them at first. It really is, because everybody who's in the dating scene knows that they have to portray themselves a certain way. And so you may not notice that somebody is avoidant for months, maybe even a year. The current thinking is that people can keep a mask on, you know, as long as you're not living together where you see the person many hours a day, that you're still living separately, that some people can keep a mask up for up to 18 months to 2 years. You may see signs before that, that they're avoidant or non-committal, but they'll quickly mask that again once they're confronted. And so it may take a full 18 months or 2 years for the mask to fully drop.
That's absolutely terrifying. Yes. So you can date, yeah, Loretta said yes. That's scary. That's a real life horror movie. So you could date someone for 18 months to 2 years and then find out they are a totally different person.
Well, I don't know about totally different person. In some cases, that's going to be true, right? So you hear about these scammers who end up marrying people and then stealing all their money. Those are people who clearly portray themselves one way and then are very different underneath. But short of that kind of extreme, people can keep a mask up that they're going to be a good emotional partner. But when push comes to shove, they don't. Or if too many problems pile up, then they just bail very quickly.
We'll talk about anxious attachment in a second. But before we do, I got a question for you. Can you tell me three good things about dating an avoidant? Can you think of three good things that might come when someone is in a relationship with an avoidant person?
No, probably not. Well, one good thing is that because they don't have that underlying sense of intimacy, that they may be on a surface level, tons of fun, very charming. They know how to compensate for the fact that there's not going to be a sense of intimacy. And so they may be very fascinating people to be in a relationship with, as long as you're not going to count on them long term.
Do these characteristics show up in friendships and at work? I mean, if someone's an avoidant and they don't want to confront a problem, what will they do when they've got some conflict at their workplace or with their friends? What happens?
I suspect there is a high correlation between avoidance in romantic relationships and avoidance when there are conflicts either in work or in friendships. Because when there's too much emotionality or too much being asked of them, the avoidant person's first response is to just get out of the situation, or to give someone the silent treatment, or to take a break from the situation. And it's unlikely that they're going to be able to overcome that in other situations like friendship or work. So you'll see the same kinds of behaviors crop up. Now, in a work situation, they will be more likely to be able to hide it because, of course, you don't live with your coworkers typically. In friendships, you may also not see it to the same extent because, again, you typically are not spending as much time with friends as you would be with a romantic partner. And you're not expecting usually as much from a friend as you are from a romantic partner. So it's going to crop up more the more that's being asked of them. And so that's going to be easiest to detect, I think, in a romantic relationship.
That's very interesting. So we know avoidants have a ton of problems. You would recommend no one date an avoidant, or if they do, proceed with caution. What about anxiously attached people? So I'm going to be honest. When I hear horror stories from my friends about people they are going on dates with, it seems like a lot of the really scary people are anxiously attached. Those are the people who are calling them all the time, who are sending them lots of text messages, who are really set on getting a commitment very early on. What do you think about dating anxious people? What are some problems and some benefits that come with that?
It can certainly be challenging because anxious people are going to ask for a lot of emotionality and a lot of reassurance, and they're going to very heavily rely on their romantic partner or sometimes even their friends to more of an extent than those other people can really give. Now, it is possible with someone who is securely attached to help the anxious person overcome some of those insecurities. And so that over time, there is a possibility that anxiously attached people can become more secure if they're with a securely attached person who is willing to give them what they need and to reassure them appropriately. However, it can also feel as if they're very clingy. And so people who want more of a sense of independence or don't constantly want to be reassuring an anxious person may not be able to take it.
So one of my really good friends is very anxiously attached, and she is now in a very healthy relationship with someone who's secure. But in her dating life before meeting him, she was going with all of these avoidants. She really hated it because none of them were giving her what she wanted or needed. Then she meets someone who's anxiously attached and she hates it. It's like horrible. She was totally disgusted by it because it was like this guy just wanted so much from her. What happens when anxious people, you know, kind of meet? Is that a common outcome? Because I remember thinking, well, if you want so much attention from someone and they want attention, that should theoretically be a great relationship. But it doesn't really seem like it ever is.
Yeah, that sounds like a very high octane combination because they are both going to be very needy and perhaps no one is getting their needs met. Now, they may also understand each other, but sometimes that catalyst for someone who, like your friend, who was anxiously attached, starts dating someone anxiously attached and goes, wow, this is really irritating behavior. I think I need to change myself so that I'm not behaving like this and being too clingy and too needy. We use relationships as catalysts for changing our own behavior and for kind of self-assessing. And that can be a good thing.
Very cool. I mean, self-improvement is always a great thing. If someone is anxiously attached and they're wanting to improve themselves and become better to be in relationships with, how can they do that?
Therapy never hurts, because then if you can find a good therapist who can guide you on that path and steer you to some good materials, then that's always good. But we also have the internet, and adult attachment styles have become really big for people to research and to write about. So you can always find things online, but I also think you can practice becoming more of a secure person with friends, so that you don't have to keep throwing yourself into relationships and then, you know, having all these horrible breakups that are traumatic and then you finally change yourself. You can also change it with friends, that if you find yourself being too needy with friends, for example, if you're anxious, you can go, okay, I know what I'm doing, and then maybe try and handle some of the anxiety yourself by going for walks or exercising. That's usually a good way to handle anxiety. And so you take control of the situation.
Noted. So someone who is anxious can get better by practicing relationships with secure people. Someone who is avoidant just shouldn't date at all. Like, they should just take themselves out of the gene pool, right?
Well, that's probably extreme, and it's not going to happen, because they are a very high proportion of people who are in the dating pool. Avoidant attachment, especially the dismissive avoidant, is the hardest to change, because these are people who have grown up thinking that other people really can't be relied on, and not learning how to have deep emotional connections if it requires too much of them. So it's very difficult to get them to change. And dismissive avoidants tend to have high self-esteem, but they oftentimes have lower views of other people. So even when breakups happen, they may think to themselves, well, it wasn't me. I'm not the one who needs to change.
Why do breakups hurt so much?
Well, as I said at the beginning, we are social creatures. We have evolved to be in social situations. That is important to us. So we have evolved to develop emotions that are based on a sense of connectedness. And what they have found is that either when you suffer a breakup, which is a loss of a connection, or you're ostracized by a group, that it actually activates the same areas in the brain as physical pain. So one interesting thing is, after a breakup, some sites actually recommend taking Motrin, that people who take Motrin, which is a physical pain reliever, may actually do better after the breakup than people who don't, because it activates areas of the cingulate gyrus.
Fascinating. So painkillers and don't date avoidant people. That is Loretta's dating advice. So it's been studied extensively just how terrible parental emotional neglect can be. But I wonder, like, what are some beneficial elements of having an insecure attachment style? Are there negative sides of secure attachment?
I don't know if it's linked so much to insecure attachment itself, but certainly people who grow up where their emotional needs are not being met, or they're neglected, or even abused children, they start to pay attention to other people's emotions because they have to for survival, right? They have to know, if they're in a household where there's abuse, when, you know, mom or dad comes in from work and they seem happy, okay, that's all right. But they also have to pay attention to, okay, do they have a negative look on their face that indicates I might be subject to abuse tonight? So they learn to pay attention to other people's cues. Quite a few people who have come from abusive or insecure attachment families then go on to be highly empathetic, because they can cue into other people's emotions. And at least some abused children go on to become social workers and people who advocate for abuse victims. So it is possible to turn a negative into a positive, where you then use the knowledge that you acquired growing up to make other people's lives better and to pay attention to when they might need something.
I was reading about that. People who are anxious are more likely to have good health outcomes because they are more in tune with looking at their bodies and asking for help. I'm not going to ask you to tell me any more good things about avoidant people. What are some downsides to being securely attached? I always hear of securely attached people as, you know, the best people to get in relationships with. But very obviously, there are secure people that have bad relationship habits. What might some of those be?
I guess securely attached people could occasionally stay in a bad relationship either because they feel confident enough in themselves that they think, well, I can handle it. I actually know of someone who stayed in an abusive relationship who at least initially seemed kind of healthy because she said, well, I'm strong enough to handle this. The other thing that could happen is securely attached people, because they do pay attention to, am I getting my needs met, might be perceived by dating partners as giving up too easily because they think, well, okay, I've put some effort into this relationship. I'm not getting back what I'm putting into it. So I need to leave the relationship. And the other person may think, well, why didn't they give us more of a chance?
Noted. So that makes me think. As you know, I love talking to people about relationships, and I've met a few people who've identified as securely attached, who've gone 10 to 20 years without really having a close relationship simply because people do not meet their standards. Would you really consider them securely attached?
Would be hard to know. I think if you haven't had a relationship for 10 years, you might start to suspect that the person is avoidant and not securely attached. And some of this, I think, is a product of today's dating. So, for example, one of my colleagues, David Buss, had done research showing that use of dating apps makes people much pickier and much less willing to give someone extra chances because it's like this, you know, buffet in front of you. And you think, well, okay, that person was kind of cool, but I can probably do better. And so I think it is leading to, even though most relationships nowadays, or what is it, a third, are due to online connections that people make, it does cause a very different psychology where you're not as willing to settle. And as a result, people may not give a dating partner as much time as would be necessary to develop a strong relationship, that they just think, well, I'll see if I can do better with someone else.
I read something very interesting about how the very act of swiping left on someone can make someone feel like they are more attractive, which to me, I mean, I don't know if that's true, but like if you're, you know, just an average Joe and you're going through a dating app and you're swiping left on a bunch of people, cognitively, it might make you feel more attractive. Do you feel like people who are more physically attractive have stronger tendencies to be avoidant and people who are maybe less attractive have stronger tendencies to be anxious?
I certainly don't know of any such research. You know, there is something known as mate value. Physical attractiveness clearly plays a role in that, right? So you have a sense of what you're bringing to the dating relationship. Sometimes people are objectively correct, right? So someone who is personable and intelligent and good looking may have an accurate view of their mate value. And then sometimes it's going to be inaccurate, where there are people who have high mate value who don't have high self-esteem. And so they don't think they're as good as they are. And then you get the converse. People really aren't bringing very much mate value to the situation, and yet they think that they are.
So attachment style is not really related to how attractive someone is.
It can have a role, clearly. As far as I know, there's no direct correlation between attractiveness and attachment style. However, we do know that people, even children who are attractive, get treated differently by adults. Physically attractive children and adults, other people think they have more good characteristics like honesty than they may actually have. So it's certainly possible that someone who is physically attractive over time is getting more reinforcement from social connections, and as a result, develops a psychology in line with that. Is there some really easy cause-effect between attractiveness and attachment style? No, I don't think so.
Noted. So speaking of dating, if you were to give each attachment style a piece of dating advice, what would it be? So we've got four. I guess we have fearful, or we have the reactive one too, but I don't know if we can really give them dating advice. You're shaking your head. Yeah, that's not really, that's like the feral child, correct? Those are the people that grow up with reactive attachment. So if you're going to give someone who is secure, someone who's anxious, someone who's dismissive avoidant, and someone who's fearful avoidant dating advice, and it's genuine dating advice, well, what would it be?
All right. Well, that's pretty difficult. Securely attached people clearly, I think, already have a leg up because they both will pay attention to what their partner needs, but also they have a sense of being able to give intimacy themselves. So I'm not sure that securely attached people really need general dating advice. The anxiously attached builds up your sense of self-esteem and sense of boundaries so that you don't seem as needy when you do get into a relationship. And if you're going to get into a relationship with someone who's fairly compassionate and willing to help you, perhaps with insecurities. For avoidant attached, there is the possibility to change and either try and find someone who has the exact same expectations as you in a relationship, or, you know, to try and work slowly at increasing your intimacy, maybe with friends.
And what about fearful avoidant?
Yeah, that one, because it has elements of both the avoidant and the anxious, I guess the same advice I would give to either one of those. They're going to have the insecurities of the anxiously attached person, and yet the tendency to run away of the avoidant attached person. And so they're going to have to be a little bit more patient with allowing a relationship to flourish rather than run away too quickly, but also try and rein in some of the neediness.
Noted. There's something I wanted to ask you about. So I downloaded this app called Relish, which is for people in relationships. When you're using it, you can put your attachment style and the other person puts their attachment style. They have these animals for it. So people who were securely attached were the golden retriever. People who were anxious were a cockatoo. People who were fearful avoidant were a rabbit. You know, it's like people try to get close to you and then you run away. People who were avoidant were a snake. And I remember they took it off and then replaced it with another animal. I don't know. What animals would you give each of the attachment styles?
So if we had to assign animals to each of the attachment styles, maybe for secure, it would be a Saint Bernard, right? They're hardworking. They are really loyal. For an anxious, maybe the stereotype of a Chihuahua. And I say that knowing that there are many fabulous Chihuahuas, including the one I have. But if you think of the stereotype of the kind of very nervous, yappy dog, then an anxious person might seem to be kind of needy and always asking for help. Fearful, avoidant, rabbit is probably a good one, if that's what Relish used. Dismissive, avoidant, I would say a male lion, right? They just kind of lie around. They expect the female lions to do things for them and not really worry about it, right? They don't take care of the young. They are just content to be the king. How's that?
That's really good. I feel bad for any avoidant you've dated for some reason. I know I shouldn't, but it doesn't sound like you like them very much.
Spent the day lying in bed, try to figure out what's wrong with my head, but I know I won't burn out. I got some friends who take care of me, and I got some friends who take care of me, but I know I won't burn out. I won't burn out, but on the days when I It just seems to follow me.